From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every week and more, David Brooks tells us what he thinks about politics, about our culture. In his new book, his lens is on character, moral character. He wrote it in response to what he calls our society's emphasis on the big me, our focus on resumes, the age of the selfie. He believes true life satisfaction, value, is elsewhere, in kindness, bravery, self-sacrifice. And he says he and we need more of all of that. He's thinking about how to build it. This hour on Point, David Brooks and the Road to Character. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this the age-old exhortation to be good, be better, or have we gone further astray? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is David Brooks, columnist for The New York Times, a regular commentator on NPR's All Things Considered. His new book is The Road to Character. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Brooks, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you again.
What do you want from us, sir? What do you want from yourself that you haven't been getting?
I don't know what I want from us. It maybe started out more personal. Occasionally you run across people who just radiate with a sort of inner light. About once a month I come across someone and they just seem like transparently good. And they could have achieved great career success or not. A friend of mine was a camp counselor, I remember, and he just, you were just joyous around him. I was with some people who teach immigrants how to read about a year or two ago, and you walk into a room and they just seem patient and caring. They make you feel valued. They make you feel funny. They're not thinking about what wonderful work they're doing. They're not thinking about themselves at all. And so they just serve as sort of models of what's possible and what's possible in the world around us. And my reaction was, I've achieved more career success than I ever imagined I would, but I haven't achieved that. And so I wanted to see how that is achieved. And so I spent a few years studying the lives of people who had achieved not only career success, but inner depth. And some of them were religious, like Dorothy Day. Some of them were not religious, like George Marshall or George Eliot, the great novelist. Some of them were white. Some of them were black, men, women. They were all different sorts. But they all had one thing in common, which was that they were messes as human beings in their 20s, and they were really magnificent by the time they were 70. And I just want to know how they did that.
You write about resume virtues versus eulogy virtues, and I guess we know what you mean, but lay it out for us.
Yeah, the resume virtues are the things we bring to the marketplace, whether you're good at being a journalist or a teacher or whatever. The eulogy virtues are the things they say about us after we're dead, whether we're courageous, honest, brave, capable of great love, what kind of relationships we were able to build. And we all know that the eulogy virtues are more important than the resume ones. But I think we live in a culture that is more articulate about the resume ones, that we have an educational system that teaches kids job skills. We have a college admissions process that emphasizes the skills you're going to learn in college, the skills you're going to learn in high school. And then we have a self-help culture, the books in the bookstores, the magazines, how to brand yourself, how to find work that's rewarding. And that's all great. I'm not against work. I'm not even against consumerism. But I do think it crowds out the other side, which is the eulogy side. And so I think a lot of us, it's not that people are bad, but they're less articulate about their own internal lives. They have less clear strategies. Well, I'll say that for myself, less clear strategies of how to build a good inner life. And the challenge is that the two sides of our nature operate by different logics. The resume side operates by an economic logic that input leads to output, effort leads to reward. The eulogy side operates by a moral logic, which is different and inverse. So you have to, you have to lose yourself to find yourself. You have to conquer your desires to get what you crave. You have to give to receive. Success leads to the greatest failure sometimes, which is pride. Failure sometimes leads to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. And so the book is really an attempt to explore that other side of our nature, which is not to renounce having a great job. I'm all for that. But I just wanted to spend some time thinking about the other piece of life and hopefully become at least a little more knowledgeable and articulate about it.
This may be elemental to our times, but it's elemental to human nature, as I read you. I mean, you go all the way back to the Garden of Eden and a very interesting a rabbi's analysis of Adam himself, no less, or a couple of Adams in a way.
Yeah, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who's from Boston, said we have two sides of our nature, Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the resume side, what he called majestic Adam, who wants to build and create Adam 2 is what he called humble Adam, the inner Adam who wants to return home and enjoy a family meal and wants to believe in truth and represent truth and live according to truth, to be good inside. And Soloveitchik argued that these two sides of our nature are in tension and in confrontation. And I do think that's true. You know, a friend of mine, or not a friend, but a guy I ran across, said he hires people for his firm. And I said, well, what question do you ask in the job interview process? And he said, you know, I asked them, tell me a time you told the truth and it hurt you. And that's a test of whether people are sometimes putting Adam 2 above Adam 1. And that's a pretty good way to think about things, I think.
Adam does take us all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Is there something about the time we're in now that makes this tension greater? Or as Adam 2, the more the deeper virtues, has that guy lost the battle?
I think a few things have changed. I never believe in culture's rise and decline. I don't believe in moral degradation. We all face our own challenges in our own times. But I do think a couple things have happened. One, the marketplace has gotten more competitive, so we spend a lot more time thinking about our jobs. Second, we live in an internet culture that encourages a lot of self-promotion and self-branding, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter. And third, I think there's been a philosophical shift. There are always two big romantic traditions, or romantic and realistic tradition. One tradition believes we're wonderful inside, which we associate with Rousseau, and most of the problems of the world are caused by social convention. So it says we're wonderful inside and we should trust ourselves, but distrust the things outside of ourselves. And then another tradition, a realistic tradition that we associate with Augustine and Kant and other people, says we should distrust ourselves and trust the things outside of ourselves. In other words, we're splendidly endowed, but we're also broken. We're all broken inside, and we need to heal that brokenness. And we live in a culture that says follow your passion, be true to yourself, trust yourself. I think that sense that we're broken inside has a bit been lost. I'm not sure we raise our kids that way. I'm not sure I was raised that way. And that, therefore, we need to work on that. And that to become a good person, you have to take your broken places. Are you, you know, in the characters in the book, I have the character Bayard Rustin, who was egotistical. Dwight Eisenhower was angry all the time. George Eliot was emotionally needy. And they had a brokenness, but they transcended it over the course of their lives. And that was really the core struggle of their life.
When you say we're looking at follow your passion, be true to yourself, a lot of people's minds may just go back to the 60s. But you say in the book, no, it's not about that. There's a different moment here. I have a little maybe of the sound of that. You cite a... This is the day after the Japanese surrender in 1945, so we're back in greatest generation territory. There was a radio show that went out to troops called Command Performance. And there's something in the tone of it that caught your ear. Here's from that, 1945, just after the Japanese surrender. This is singer Bing Crosby hosting the thing. Listen to the tone as Bing Crosby talks about this moment. The surrender has happened.
Well, it looks like this is it. What can you say at a time like this? You can't throw your skimmer in the air. That's for run-of-the-mill holidays. I guess all anybody can do is thank God it's over.
Bing Crosby, 1945. What caught your ear there, David? What comparison does it bring to mind?
Well, they just achieved the greatest victory, a great victory. And he went on to say how we should just be modest. And then later in that broadcast, Burgess Meredith got out there and read a passage from Ernie Pyle, the great war correspondent, who said, we didn't win this war because we're better than anybody else, or we're God's chosen people. We just want it because we happen to have a lot of material abundance and we have great allies. We should just try to stay humble and be worthy of the peace. So it was a tone of great humility that struck me, and I found very beautiful about that broadcast, which was an impulse. It was literally at the moment they discovered they had won the war. And then I listened to that on NPR one night. It was rebroadcast on a show that we get down here in Washington. And I found it so beautiful. And I go inside. And I turn on the TV, I watch a football game, a quarterback throws a pass to a wide receiver, and he gets tackled after a two-yard gain, and the defensive player does what all professional athletes do after moments of supreme personal achievement.
Yes.
He does a self-puffing victory dance to himself. And it occurred to me, I'd seen a bigger self-puffing dance after a two-yard gain than after winning World War II. And that, to me, symbolized a shift in culture, a shift in a culture of self-effacement, which says, I'm no better than anybody else, but nobody's better than me, to a culture of distinction which says, look at my achievement. This is what I've done. And I wouldn't ever want to go back to the 1940s. It was racist. It was sexist. It was anti-Semitic. But I do think in one respect that what they had was a little more common and a little more lovely. And I should say it was not the 60s that ended that. It was the 40s. It was the late 40s. After the war, after the Depression, they decided we're just going to spend. We want to relax. We've suffered hardship for 16 years. We're just going to relax. And so we became very quickly a very materialistic culture, much more materialistic. And we cast aside the awareness of our own brokenness, our own sinfulness, and we just wanted to relax and really think highly of ourselves. And so that cultural shift, I think, happened from the greatest generation. It was not the boomers that did it. It was the greatest generation that did it.
So here we are, 2015. Are you finding hunger for this conversation about character building, self-effacement, or are you finding resistance?
Well, I guess I would say I'm finding hunger. I think it's a universal trait. We want to live better. We want to be the most morally good as we can be. One of my students came up to me and said, we're so hungry. We're so hungry. We want to be good. We just don't have the language. And so, but there used to be a lot of writers in the public sphere who were talking about this, whether they were Abraham Joshua Heschel in the 50s or Reinhold Niebuhr, or in the 60s and 70s, there were a new group of people who were talking about this. I don't think there's many people talking about it. And so, I don't know if my book's any good. I really don't know at this point whether my article's good. But I will say I do think I'm responding to a need. And my piece of evidence, they're going to sound commercial, but they happen to be true. Mm. I wrote a piece for the Sunday Times the Sunday Review section about 9 days ago. Mm-hmm. And it stayed at number one and most emailed for a long time. I think it's still up there at number four.
And
so.
It's sort of a recipe for deepening one's character.
Yeah. And my book, again, I'm not bragging. And believe me, the people who are buying the book, they haven't read it yet, so they don't know if it's any good. But it is number one on Amazon. And I take that as evidence, not about me and not about my book, but that there is a hunger for this out there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist David Brooks about his new book, The Road to Character. He's talking about moral character. He says we need more of it. We've drifted away from that as a priority. Joins us from Washington. You can read an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get a caller from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Greg, you're on the air with David Brooks. Thank you for calling.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say that I applaud Mr. Brooks and his new book. I hear more and more about it on the radio talk shows, and maybe it's making inroads. You know, with the competition for jobs today, especially the young people, they have these resume writers that embellish resumes because the resume writers know that they're not going directly to the decision maker. Now they're going through,
algorithms that look for certain keywords to pop up. I've read, Greg.
Right. They're going right.
Software almost.
Yeah, that's right. They're going through layers of human resources, people.
Yeah.
And rarely do you get to go to a decision maker or the right hand man anymore.
Hey, Greg,
so I hope that this makes some impact.
You raise an interesting point, David Brooks. Do we live in a time when the economy has been so stretched that people can't afford to have character? You describe a tension between Adam 1 and Adam 2. Is there a tension between success in our economy and the kind of character that you're applauding, encouraging here?
Yeah, first, a couple issues. I think partly it's just become so competitive. It takes so much time to think about your career. You have to plan it so much. Starting from childhood, you're just thinking, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I get into that school? How do I do that? I think it just crowds out. Second, the pace of life is faster. It's harder to hear the soft, still voices that do make up our inner life. They don't cry for attention. I have in the book a chapter on Dorothy Day, a great woman who was very self-critical. But she had to take some time each day to separate herself from the world and to write in her journal to really think about that. The third issue is, does character make you more successful or less? I'm not sure. I think sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes having good character and being a person of integrity can hurt your career in some instances. There's a case where George Marshall, one of my characters, never wanted to be a self-promoter. Mm-hmm. And he was passed over for a great promotion to run the D-Day invasion because he refused to self-promote. But it did make him a great person in the long run. It did help him in the long run. And then the final issue that I've thought about, and I have an opinion, though I'm not certain about it, is this a first world problem? I'm upper middle class. I have more money than average. And those of us who have money, do we have the luxury of thinking about these things in a way people who are struggling don't? And I think my answer to that is no, it's not related to economics. I know many, many people in the churches and the synagogues and the mosques are filled with many, many people who are poor and struggling, but who take their inner lives with great seriousness and who want to be good. And so they may have not as much money and they have more stress and more problems as a result, but they set aside time to have a life that they can be proud of. And likewise, I know a lot of rich people who certainly could use a little setting aside time to think about that.
Let's go to Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air with David Brooks.
Thank you, Tom. I've enjoyed the program, and it's interesting. I'm an unpaid volunteer firefighter, an unpaid volunteer rescue squad member.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an unpaid volunteer medical first responder. I've donated over 10 gallons of my blood.
That's a lot.
To help my fellow man.
Yeah.
Now, in 2004, the greedy rich got their tax cuts to create jobs. They did not create the jobs. They still get their tax cuts. Andrew Carnegie started out poor, got taken under wing by one of the company executives and became multimillion-dollar Richmond. Hired gunfighters to fight people that wanted to organize to get a decent wage. But later on, when he had amassed so many millions and he knew he couldn't take it with him, he bought libraries and museums for people to experience. But those people, if he had given them a decent wage, they would have been able to buy those museums and libraries, and their children have been able to go to school to be able to read.
Terry, we've got it, and kudos to you for your work as a volunteer firefighter and rescue squad guy and all that blood donation. David Brooks, is there a tension between how rewards are distributed, what gets rewarded economically in our country, and the kind of virtue you're describing here? You're sort of a moderate but conservative voice, and you hear Terry there looking at tax cuts, and I know there's a big spectrum of things here, perhaps from philosophy at the public policy, but they certainly intersect. Is there a tension between conservative tax policy, let's just take as an example, and the kind of virtue you're describing? Dorothy Day might see one, I suppose.
Yeah, she would. Some of the characters in my book were quite left-wing. Mm-hmm. Dorothy Day and Frances Perkins were quite progressive. You know, I guess I would say a couple things. First, you know, a lot of what happens in life and what matters in life, it happens beneath the level of politics. One of my characters is Samuel Johnson. He had a couplet, which I'm going to mangle a little, but it was of all the things that human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause and cure. And what he meant by that, when we think about our lives, we often think it's about the nature of relationships, the nature of our community service, and that's beneath politics. And so I think whether you're liberal or conservative, there's things that shape our lives are non-political. And so this book, believe me, I write about politics a lot, so it's not that I don't care about it.
And politics also do shape our lives.
Right. Well, I agree with that as well. This book is more about the non-political side of our life. As to whether it's intention, we can have an argument about which tax policy produces the most economic growth. And we can have an argument about Andrew Carnegie. He's a good example of someone who was both rapacious and also did good. And an example of what I'm talking about when I talk about the broken timber tradition, that most of us are deeply flawed but also are capable of good. I guess the goal for all of us, and it's sort of the goal for a lot of my characters, is to merge Adam 1 and Adam 2, bring your whole self to work. And so that if you're bringing gunfighters to your workplace to chase away a union or whatever you're doing, have at least enough moral sense to question yourself and think, is this really the person I want to be? And I do think that's the goal. Whether we always achieve that is harder to say.
You mentioned Dorothy Day a couple of times, and of course she had the Catholic Worker newspaper. She had soup kitchens and more in her. As you described, she said, don't just think about it. Just go out and do it. Help people. Here she was in 1971 PBS interview talking about her values. Dorothy Day.
If your brother is hungry, you feed him. You don't meet him at the door and say, go be thou filled, or wait for a few weeks and you'll get a welfare check. And you sit him down and feed him. And so that's how the soup kitchen started.
Don't farm it out to the future or somebody else. Sit down and feed that person. Direct. Megan, Middletown, Rhode Island. You're on with David Brooks. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I'm just so excited to get a chance to talk to David Brooks because I'm ashamed to say I only learned of him a few years ago, and I just speak his word all over the place now. But I am so excited about this topic, and I intend to buy the book, Mr. Brooks. I'm very excited about this. I've worked in a church. I was a volunteer at first, and I'm still there now. It's a paid position now, but it's I've been here for 29 years working with youth. And we do teach them about Dorothy Day and Mother Teresa. It's not about religion. It's about being a better person. And we have them work in soup kitchens. And it's just, it's such an important theme right now, because I think we have completely forgotten decency. And it's a challenge for all of us.
What's the evidence of that, Megan? Is that just the same thing people say in all eras? We're not as good as we should be or we used to be?
I think we're not as good as we used to be, and I don't think we're as good as we should be. And I see a lot of, I even have friends now that, you know, they own guns and they believe in this. And I just wish, and I don't want to make any political statements, but I feel like when people resort to that, it's immediate, and that life is gone. And we try to teach our kids, this is not the important thing. Helping one person at a time. You don't have to be overwhelmed by it, but do something. Clean the beach. Give away your two small sweaters to the Goodwill. Work at a soup kitchen. I mean, we have to start in small ways to realize that we are not the highest power in creation. We are here to help one another.
Megan, I so appreciate your call, and I'm sure David Brooks, here's your affectionate reading there. David, I guess you are bringing away a generational complaint here. Are you a boomer throwing sticks at even younger people and saying you're not adequately focused on your moral character?
No, I don't think so. First, let me thank Megan for her work and for her nice words. I really don't have a machine to measure other people's souls. I don't know, let alone a whole generation's souls, let alone a whole society's. I just know I think we'd be better if we were a little more like Dorothy Day. If you heard that clip that you played, I'm so glad you played that. What you hear in her words, and she's all over YouTube if anybody wants to find her, is a simplicity and a directness. And that's not the way she was when she was 20. She was very disorganized. She led a very disorganized life, a life she was ashamed of, and a lot of carousing, a lot of drinking, and abortion, suicide attempt. And the birth of her child really gave her a focus and gave her a sense of love. And out of that love came a tremendous sense of gratitude. She was so grateful for her daughter. And that gratitude turned to worship, and it made her religious. And then she organized her life around those soup kitchens. And around the homeless shelters and around communes and the Catholic Worker, the newspaper you mentioned. And so she went from being disorganized to being very simple and focused. And it wasn't only the service she did, though she did great service sitting there day after day handing out bread and soup. But she also at night, and she kept a journal with her all the time, and she wrote about how she was doing. Was she being flattered by all the people who admired her? Was she living up to the example she hoped she in her Catholic faith, she believed God and Jesus had set? And if she wasn't living up to the sample that day, that was a bad day for her. So her greatest drama was not external, it was internal, whether she was living up to the sort of person she believed called to be. And so she imposed a lot of suffering on herself. She was very self-critical of herself, but she led a very inspiring life. And whether we're good or bad, we'd be better if we learned about her and tried to be a little more like her.
You say we're not adequately at grips, perhaps, with that internal conversation about our broken timber. You may need to just explain the whole broken timber idea. It doesn't have so much great wide currency these days.
Yeah, the phrase comes from Immanuel Kant. He said, out of the broken timber of humanity, no straight thing was made. And the idea is that we're born with weakness. The old-fashioned word is sin. That's a word now that's used mostly in the context of fattening desserts. But I think it's a word worth reclaiming. And it doesn't mean we're depraved like some of the Puritans thought we were. It means we have a tendency to screw things up. And my favorite definition of sin is Augustine's. It's having disordered loves. And he meant this, that we all love a lot of things. We love our family. We love truth. We love beauty. We love money. We love status. But we all know that some loves are higher than others. We all know our love for our family is higher than our love for, you know, popularity. But sometimes we take a lower love and we put it above a higher love. So if somebody tells you a secret and then you blab that secret at a dinner party so you'll, you know, appear witty, then you're putting your love of popularity above your love of friendship. And we do these sorts of things all the time. And trying to get better is just a matter of putting your loves in the right order and living according to that. And I think that's a beautiful definition of sinfulness, because it doesn't mean we're black inside. It just means we have a tendency to screw things up a lot.
Acknowledging that and working with and through that is part of what you're talking about here, and certainly not just blithely ignoring it.
Right. I do think we have, there was a movement starting in the 1950s led by a guy named Carl Rogers called humanistic psychology, and that taught the opposite message, which is that you're deeply wonderful inside. You have a natural tendency to toward goodness, and you just need to actualize that tendency. You need to liberate yourself from external restraints. I disagree with that. I think we are not naturally good. Parts of us are naturally good. Parts of us are naturally not good. And that some of the external restraints are there to prevent the greedy and selfish parts of ourselves from making us even worse.
But maybe back in the day, in the era you describe as sort of a hinge here when society changed, the late 40s and on, maybe people felt oppressed by all those years of, oh my God, I'm broken.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, societies do change for a reason. And the reason the old culture, the 1940s culture that in many ways I admire, needed to change was that large numbers of people, notably minorities and women, had been taught to think too lowly of themselves. And there had to be a cultural shift to raise expectations, to raise ambitions, to raise aspirations, to create equality and to create justice. And so I understand why that old humble culture was dismissed. But I guess I would say I think we've overshot the mark now, and it's necessary to rediscover a bit and modernize a bit of that older tradition that stretches back to Augustine, stretches through George Eliot and through Kant and really back to the Bible, I guess.
Kay in Madison, Wisconsin, you're on with David Brooks.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
When I hear you talk, David, I keep thinking of the word holy or spiritual in a more focused sense. Sometimes people that I see that they almost feel as though they have a light around them. They have kind of an aura, and people respond to that. It could be somebody like Pope Francis or the Dalai Lama, or it doesn't have to be anyone that's high in a particular religion. I've experienced it around with nuns, with people who are recovering alcoholics. May feel, you know, they talk about a power greater than themselves, restore them to sanity. Some people who are addicts and in recovery have this powerful sense of a spiritual life that I think makes them very attractive to other people.
Kay, I appreciate your call. David, we just have a minute before the break. There's no question you talk about this light, this kind of luminosity. Kay takes it on to holiness and maybe even to religion, but you're not entirely building this argument around religion, though it's definitely there.
No, I think there are good people I know who are religious and wonderful people who are not religious. I think there's wonderfulness in all walks and all camps. I do think some of the categories of religion that Pope Francis maybe takes advantage of, words like sin, soul, redemption, grace, I think those are important categories, whether you're religious or not, just to give you a vocabulary to think things through.
Can we develop these strengths without some deliberate cultivation?
I think you need to work at it. I think you need to think in these categories, or else, I am just speaking from my own life, I think we have a tendency to drift off course and settle for a moral mediocrity if not focusing on these categories. I think it requires some intention and some conversations with friends.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the New York Times columnist, David Brooks. His new book is The Road to Character. He's talking about moral character, says we need more of it. We've drifted away from that as a priority. He's got a lot of wonderful exemplars of this in the book, from George Eliot and Samuel Johnson and George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, St. Augustine, Dorothy Day. One of those he mentions, Frances Perkins. She was a labor secretary under FDR, first female cabinet member in the United States, I believe, witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911. This was the terrible fire in New York. 147 people were killed. Here she is in 1964 talking about that experience and her reaction to seeing that fire.
I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere. It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. Mea culpa, mea culpa.
It was work she had done within herself then that led her in her position as labor secretary to really take these things public. Dwight D. Eisenhower is another who's profiled by David Brooks. Of course, a big general, had problems with anger in his own life, and yet ends up leading the country, putting on a bright face, but also pointing to moral issues for the whole country. This was from a special Eisenhower address, 1957. He talked about the racial integration in Little Rock, Arkansas, and about the importance of standing up for human rights. And this was 1957, the president saying about the importance of combating racism at home.
At a time when we face grave situations abroad, because of the hatred that communism bears toward a system of government based on human rights, it would be difficult to exaggerate the harm that is being done to the prestige and influence, and indeed to the safety, of our nation and the world.
President Dwight Eisenhower, getting control of his anger was enough to put him in your pantheon, David.
Yeah, and it should be said, none of these figures are perfect. They're all human and broken and fallen in their own ways. Eisenhower, I think, was an example of somebody who really took his anger and turned into cheerfulness and really made himself strong in the weakest spot. But that doesn't mean he didn't have serious flaws. You know, in civil rights, he didn't really do as much as he could have done for the cause of civil rights. When Joe McCarthy attacked Eisenhower's friend, George Marshall, and Eisenhower was running for president, he was silent when he shouldn't have been. There was a woman who really was his mistress, I guess, during World War II, Kay Summersby, we think, and he treated her shabbily at the end. So all these characters, I think, exemplify something that's a model for us, but they also reveal, you know, what's true of all of us, of course, that serious, serious problems.
Good questions for you online here as well. Sylvia is writing to us on Facebook, and she says, I want to know if Brooks recognizes and addresses the degree to which women have often been socialized to put others first, even to their own detriment, while men have often been socialized to make their own lives the first priority. She writes, David, while I respect his views, I wonder if he doesn't have some major blind spots for those whose lives are so very different from his own.
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent point. I tried to say earlier in the program that one of the reasons the culture needed to change was because women had been taught to put others first, which is great, but also to the expense of themselves. And so that did need to change. And so women's sights could be raised. And I mentioned in the book, I have an example of Katharine Graham, who was heiress to the Washington Post fortune, but really the newspaper was run by her husband. And she had been trained to think very lowly of herself and not to really let her light shine. When her husband committed suicide, suddenly she was thrust in the role of running the Washington Post. And she found she could do it. And the story of her life is a story of someone who found strength in herself and who rose from being told she could do too little to realizing what she was capable of. And she managed to combine both, Adam 1 and Adam 2. She managed to really run that paper with great strength in the face of Richard Nixon's fight in Watergate, but to do so with humility. And many of the characters in the book are women who suffered from sexism, but who nonetheless were able to summon the strength to lead the sorts of lives, whether it was George Eliot, who did it through love, whether it was Frances Perkins, who did it through vocation, Dorothy Day, who did it through service, Ida Eisenhower, Dwight's mom, was really in some ways more impressive than he is, who did it through rare courage, just a very daring, daring woman. I think the examples apply to women and to men. And I should say to white and black, we have not talked about two great civil rights figures, not as well known as some others, but Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph, who defeated their own weaknesses and really were responsible for the March on Washington, some of the campaigns, the nonviolence campaigns, and lived lives of amazing dignity. And rigor.
Here's the voice of one of those, Philip Randolph. This was during the famous March on Washington in 1963. Here he is calling on everybody to stand up for real racial equality and for the working poor.
It's our fervent plea for strong voices to be raised from all areas of our society, out of varying traditions and interests, to arouse the conscience of our land in order to achieve, in fact, that which has already been won in law.
What a voice there from Philip Randolph. Amanda in Buffalo, New York. Amanda, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just got back, actually, from a girls' weekend. I'm 29, and those of us that were there were 29 or 30.
Okay.
And our conversation for part of the weekend focused on this idea of finding success in our careers versus the tension that we feel related to society not valuing character success. And it's a very real tension that a lot of us are feeling. Some of my friends are in the financial area. Some of us are in mental health. And it's something that all of us are quite aware of.
And the tension is, do you feel that you have to sacrifice character in order to pursue successfully a career, Amanda?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think you're lucky when you don't have to. But I do think that you feel that society's undervaluing those character traits.
David, what about it for young listeners who are trying to get careers started? And, you know, many would feel this tension and wonder how to handle it.
Yeah, I've certainly, in talking about the book, I've come across the tension. I've come across, especially I'm thinking of people in finance, sometimes they come up to me and say, you know, I don't have time. My job is to produce the numbers, and I've got to do whatever I can to produce the highest numbers for my clients. And I think that's not the way you want to live, frankly. I think you want to bring your whole self to work. You want to bring a sense of integrity to work. And sure, you got to pay attention to the numbers, but you got to live in the tension between the two atoms. In journalism, we're always hungry for attention. We're sometimes invading privacy. Each profession has its own character challenges. And to try to treat people with respect is sometimes a challenge for those of us in journalism. We tend to be too crass and exploitative. And so I think every profession has its own challenge. All I can ask and all I can hope for any of us, and myself included, is that we be conscious of these challenges. I should say something about Philip Randolph. He started his career, he wanted to be a Shakespearean actor, mm-hmm. as you heard
you
in his
hear
voice.
That. Yeah.
And then one of the beautiful things about him, he had a wonderful marriage. And his last 10 years of his wife's life, she was in a wheelchair. And he read Shakespeare to her for an hour a day, which is just a nice domestic gesture of marital happiness.
Oh, it sounds just actually fantastic. Take us through some of your moral bucket list here, the kind of experiences you say that we all ought to aspire to and really enrich that inner life.
Yeah, well, there some parts of it is humility, just radical self-awareness. Parts of it is self-defeat. We talked about Dwight Eisenhower and the ability to take your weakness and be and turn into a strength. We've talked about Francis Perkins, the call within a call. Which is to, you know, that moment in your career where it's not about your money, it's about doing the job as excellently as you can do it, living up to the standards of the profession. If you're a teacher, being a teacher your identity, even if you don't get rewards back from it, but just trying to serve the role of teaching, being an instrument and a cause.
Completely identifying with that.
Right. And there, you know, we all know people who they put more into their profession than they get out of it, maybe for months and years at a time. But they don't give it up because that's who they are. And they don't, you know, I for years just really wanted to write a great book. That was my ambition. And then I realized if I set out to write a great book, I'm surely not going to do it. And because trying to just puff it up and be myself for my own sake, for my own ambition, undermines the quality of the work. And I wish I were pure enough, but I think the people who write great books, they're not trying to write a great book. They're trying to express as accurately as they can what they can, and they're just trying to live up to the craft of writing as best as they can.
It seems related to what you call the dependency leap in a way. It's not all just that inner push.
Right, and it's you've got to take – and many of the characters in my book took one big chance. Bayard Rustin was a man of great verbal talents, as great as Randolph's, his mentor. But he had an ego problem, and he treated people badly through his life, in the beginning part of his life. And because of that, he never could be the front person in the civil rights movement. And so he got pushed to the background. And he had to decide, you know, how am I going to live? And, you know, he had double disadvantages. He was a member of minority. He was a gay man. And he said, you know, this is what life is assigned to me, but I'm going to serve behind the scenes. And he really was the motive and organizer for the March on Washington, and achieved an amazing service writing for Martin Luther King, working for Randolph, and then coming into his own later in life. But it took some periods of submersion, of self-defeat, self-quieting, for him to achieve what he wanted to achieve.
You're right about what you call the conscience leap, David.
Yeah, I use the example of George Eliot, who, you know, took this gigantic chance with her husband, George Lewes. And when she married Lewes, she was ostracized. She effectively married him, not legally married him, because he was already married, and in those days, divorces were not possible. And she lost her relationship with her family, with society.
So, of course, the great English novelist and journalist.
And right.
And, a woman know, and with the name George, taking the name George, yep.
And at one point, he said to her after they were married, she made the leap knowing what it was going to cost her. And she said, you know, I'll bear the burden. I've chosen the man I want to spend my life with, and I know he's worthy. And he, at one point, after they were effectively married, said, you know, you should try your hand at fiction. And she wrote a story, and she read it to him, and they started crying because he understood what a great talent she had. And he spent the rest of his life serving her. He was a writer, but he put himself second because he knew her talent was superior. And he became her agent, her publicist. He got up early in the morning, and she knew she was sensitive to criticism, like all writers. And he would cut out the articles in the newspaper that referred to her so she wouldn't have to read them. And that, in many ways, his love for her was as inspiring as hers for him.
Brett in Preston, Connecticut. Brett, you're on the air with David Brooks.
Greetings, Thomas. Thanks, David, for having this on the show. A couple things that I'd like to bring forward is that when I lost my job in corporate America and been out for about 2 years, I started doing a lot more volunteer work. So it actually drove me towards that a lot more, which I thought was a great thing because it made me have more of a conscience, as you were just talking about. But the few other things that I'd like to bring forward, and then I'll hang up and let you folks talk about it. I did clinical studies, and the idea of where they would drive you to not report your side effects because they wouldn't pay you if you reported them, you were kicked out. And then lastly, just litigation, going through civil judicial situations, and how the unethical behavior of the lawyers sleeping on pillows of dollars to put out information that really is just damaging or murder by litigation or through litigation. And I'm learning through a lot of this and starting to write more, writing obituaries of yourself to learn about yourself, and then learning to write deeply. And just lastly, you were talking about writers, and the best writers that I've seen, and what I'm finding when I'm writing my own work now, is to try to get something across and teach something that you want other people to learn rather than just give the entertainment value. And I'll hang up from here and let you guys talk about that.
Brett, I appreciate your call. There's a lot there, maybe to pick up in part on. I mean, Brett says he's become more aware and deliberate on this front since he lost his job. I mean, you point out as well, defeat can be a great, that's not a permanent defeat, but it's kind of defeat, can be a great trigger to this self-examination, David.
Yeah, and none of us should welcome it. And, you know, there was sort of a failure chic that went around as Steve Jobs gave a speech about how great failure is at Stanford University.
Yep.
And that was easy for him. He was Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, you know, we should never welcome it. But when it does happen, and it's happened to all of us, moments of suffering, you lose a job or a romantic relationship or a loved one, it is possible, and in my book, Samuel Johnson is the exemplar of this, of turning suffering into something good. And it sometimes could be just self-honesty of the time, and suffering exposes yourself in a way that nothing else quite does. And then it inspires you to want to give back and turn suffering into to connect it to a narrative of redemption and service. And so I think that's just what we've just heard about. And so I do think, you know, taking advantage of the things that happen to us and turning them into moral occasions is part of what I'm talking about here. The other thing is two things. Writing, I wasn't a big believer in journaling, and I'm a professional writer, so I don't have much. I don't have much mental energy for
journaling. Busy on that front, yeah.
But I do find a lot of people who find that very useful and find that exercise very revelatory about themselves. And then professional standards. We're all in a profession, and we all know that there are certain standards inherent in our profession, and we can all point to a person who's like the ideal in our profession. And, there's a book called The Lost Lawyer about lawyers who – there used to be a standard of excellence in the law. This author, Tony Cronman, says that some of those standards have been forgotten. It's not that people have turned bad. They've just forgotten the standard. And I do think it's worth reminding ourselves through reading biographies or running into the great mentors – who's the excellence? Who defines excellence? How do we get closer to it?
In a word, you write about an older moral ecology. Is there any going back?
No, we're not going back, and we shouldn't go back. But we can modernize, and the dead have left us gifts that we can inherit and take advantage of.
David Brooks. His new book is The Road to Character. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David, great to have you with us again. Thank you so much for your time.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.